Blog Talk Radio.
Om Shabbat Shalom, holy way of the Most High. Om Shabbat Shalom, I sense your presence. Om Shabbat Shalom, holy way of the Most High. Om Shabbat Shalom, I sense your presence. And I am the light within your soul, in the essence of truth and right, love makes the circle whole. And here we stand in line, waiting for some sacred sign, but to find the balance is the purpose of this time. To restore the balance of the universal mind. And in the presence of my Lord of light and love, everything I see aspiring to be free. And when I call to thee, and come on bended knee, surrender to the all-pervading light and love. Reflections of the one surrounding me with love. And I sense your presence. I sense your presence. I sense your presence. I sense your presence. Within and without, above and below, yeah. East, west, north and south, I sense your presence. Without and within, below and above, yeah, yeah. East, west, north and south, I sense your presence. I sense your presence. Lord of light and love, everything I find in tune with the divine. And here we stand in line, waiting for some sacred sign, but to find the balance is the purpose of this time. To restore the balance of the universal mind. I am the light within your soul, in the essence of truth and right, love makes the circle whole. And when I call to thee, and come on bending knee, surrender to the all-pervading light and love. Reflections of the one surrounding me with love. For to find the balance is the purpose of this time. To restore the balance of the universal mind. And I sense your presence. I sense your presence. I sense your presence. I sense your presence. Om Shabbat Shalom, holy way of the Most High. Om Shabbat Shalom, I sense your presence. Om Shabbat Shalom, holy way of the Most High. Om Shabbat Shalom, I sense your presence. Om Shabbat Shalom, holy way of the Most High. Om Shabbat
Holy Angel of the Most High. Om Shabbat Shalom, I sense your presence. I sense your presence.
Well, thank you for joining me tonight here on Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour, although we are running a little bit earlier than normal tonight. My name is Jessie Ann Nichols George, and I am your host tonight. The music you were listening to at the beginning of the show is I Sense Your Presence. It's by Shimshai. And I want to say just welcome, whether you're joining us for the first time or whether you're coming back because you regularly tune into the show. I really appreciate having you here. Here at Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour, I look at different ways that compassion exists in our lives, how to remove our blocks, resistances, frustrations, and more. And some weeks I'm discussing different aspects of how compassion is in and affects our life and the different areas of compassion. Some weeks I look at doing more exercises and practical implementations. Sometimes, actually a lot of times right now, I've got guests that are coming on the show so that you can learn more about their work and how other things complement and work with compassion. And I'm going to be highlighting some different musical artists along the way as well. Some nights are call-in coaching nights, and these are nights where you can call in and share what is happening in your life, and then I'll work with people live on the air to get through things and make breakthroughs, answer questions that you have. And just remember, when you're sharing your experiences and you're asking questions, that that's also going to help other people, because chances are somebody else has got a question that is similar or much like yours, or they know somebody that's going through a similar thing. So your questions are going to help other people as well. And what I want to do is I've been getting some questions, actually, in the last week about people. They say, I want to know a little bit more about your work, Jessie. I want to know a little bit more about how your work works. And some of you are, I'm sure, very familiar with Janice. She's our other female host. She's our host, female host on the flagship show on Wednesday nights. And Janice just had a birthday a couple of days ago on the 13th, and she says, please, please, please do a reading for me on the air. And so I thought, well, I'm going to kind of tie these things together a little bit. As some of you know, I call myself an integrated development specialist. And what that is I'm incorporating a lot of different areas and practices into the work that I do with people. So I got some information from Janice and that I could use to do like a little birthday reading for her of what's coming up in the year. And even though she couldn't listen in live tonight, she goes, just do it and I'll catch it on the archive. So that's what we agreed to here. And when I took a look at things, I am combining some different things from astrology and intuitive things that I see coming up, as well as some numerology in this reading for her. And Janice's birthday deduces to an 8 vibrationally, which is a very powerful spiritual number to work with. It shows that she's got a lot of force. She's got a lot of energy there. She has a natural alignment for doing the intuitive work. And then I also look at things when I'm looking at how influences are going to play out in a year, for example, of home addresses and zip codes and things like that, as well as the vibration of the year. And her home vibration is a 1, which means she really can do an extra focus on herself, and living in this particular place where she lives, it allows her to bring a lot of completion to things in her life. So she'll finish a lot of cycles because that 1 vibration coupled with the 8 vibration is bringing her into a 9 vibration. And then the area that she lives in, that zip code also deduces to an 8. And when I look at that in combination with everything, then she's running, again, when I look at the community that she's in, the city area that she's in, creates luck for her. She actually ends up getting blessings and luck through that vibration. So then when we combine everything together from her name vibration, her residence vibration, and her city vibration, she's back to her own natural 8. So it's a very natural vibrational energy for her to work under. Now, when I bring in the influences of the year for her, we're on a 6 vibration year. 2013 is a 6 vibration year. So depending on where other people's vibrations are, that can influence things. And for Janice, because she's an 8 vibration, it's bringing her into a 5 influence. So that tells me that she's going to have a lot of change coming up during this next year. And because of some of the other influences that she has in there, that change is actually going to lead to spiritual progression for her. It's going to open new doors. She's probably going to be bringing in more people, for example, like guests into both of her radio shows, I would say, that are going to have more of an international appeal or do a lot of traveling internationally. So the change is actually going to open a lot of new doors, and it's going to be a very educational year for her in there. When I look at this in relation to her personal home environment, she's going to have a lot of luck coming into the home this year. So that's going to bless her. It's like she's going to have that magic role. She's going to be on one of those magical roles this year. And then when I look at her community in general, I also see a lot of change in her community. So that change is going to be a transition that's going to bring in more cultural events, possibly more things that bring in more diversity and changes again for the better. So that's my reading for Janice tonight. Happy birthday, Janice, and hope you're out there having an amazing dinner. Now, earlier this week, one of the things that was going on is the Chinese New Year's was celebrated. And normally, this can be a time of shifting into new influences for an upcoming year. I decided to take a little different approach to feng shui. You know, a lot of people are looking at it, bringing in the feng shui specialists this year. And I thought, I want to do something different. And so I created 2 weeks where we're going to have kind of feng shui type influences going on, but they're going to be different influences. And this week is going to be a more magical approach to feng shui as it relates to our gardens and herbs and plants. And next week we're going to focus on our inner and personal feng shui, which is the qi that we carry within us. So on tonight's show, I've got Reverend Paul Byrol, and I have to apologize because in the show description, I've got his name misspelled, and his name is actually spelled B-E-Y-E-R-L. So that's B-E-Y-E-R-L is his last name on his spelling. And I just want to remind people you can always call in live to our lines at 760-542-4345 and press the number 1 to get into my caller queue. If you have any questions for Paul or myself, I will also be watching the chat area to see if there's any questions coming in there as well. And also a reminder, if you enjoy the show tonight, make certain that you tell your friends, your family, significant others, Facebook buddies, all of those great social connections, and anyone else that you feel inspired to share it with. They can always listen to it in the archives. And what they'll do is they can just use the same link that you use to get into the show to come in and listen into the archives. And then there's a couple of other areas that they can find those archive shows. And actually, one of the great new areas that they can go into is on my website, which is also at the bottom of the show description. It's JessieAnnNicholsGeorge1, that's the number 1.com. And there's actually a whole Main Street Universe tab there now, and you can go in and you can check out all the upcoming shows and archive shows for everybody on our network there. So that's another great area for them to go in and get that connection to come in. Now, before we get started, every week I like to use the 72 names of God and open up with a message from Yehuda Berg, who wrote that book, and just to kind of give us a little concept to work with for the week. And for those of you that want to look at this concept throughout the week, I've actually got it on my page under the Main Street Universe tab at the website, JessieAnnNicholsGeorge1.com. So every week it's going to be getting changed to whatever the message was for the week. And this week, I'm going to just kind of open up. What I do is randomly open here to get our message. And this week's message, or the name of God that we're working with this week, is on recognizing design beneath disorder. And it says here, there are no coincidences in life, no chance encounters, no random surprises. Whatever happens, happens for a reason. So when our world feels out of whack and we just want to scream, this name is our fast track to structure and serenity. And let's see here. It goes on to say, not a single blade of grass grows without direction from a higher power. Like an immense computer, the Creator's light processes, calculates, and accounts for everything through the law of cause and effect. When we react negatively to the apparent sudden chaos of life, we deny the underlying design of purpose and purpose of creation. Our attitude prolongs the madness, but the moment we recognize and accept hardships and all chaotic circumstances as opportunities for spiritual elevation, pain and doubt quickly disappear. We alone determine the rate at which our turmoil and pain pass. Be aware, the ego constantly attempts to slow the whole process down to a sluggish crawl by concealing the order and the cause of the chaos in front of our eyes. And the meditation that he provides here says, when you find yourself overcome with feelings or doubt of panic or with thoughts of doom, these letters reveal the order that underlies chaos. You become enlightened to the Creator's master plan as it pertains to your purpose in this world and to the problems you face. And the word or the pronunciation of the name is Yud Bet Mem. So that's Yud Bet Mem. And again, I'll have that on the website shortly after the show is over, so you can always check that out too. And as we move on here, what we're tying in, you might be wondering, well, how does all this feng shui stuff and herbal gardens tie in to compassion? How does that work? And part of it is because this ties into a lot of different areas. This ties in with compassion to our environment, and that's something that we haven't talked a lot about on this show. And the compassion with our environment means giving all life forms the opportunity to be in their full potential. And that's one of the things that Reverend Byrol will be talking about tonight, is getting things placed in the right place, getting things where they can thrive instead of just survive, where they have every chance. And as we open that up, that's a compassion that is about caring for another life form that we don't necessarily think about. As we do that, we're also benefiting ourselves and others, because when we allow something else to thrive, we're also going to improve our quality. So, for example, with herbs or gardens, when we allow our plants and our food sources to thrive, we're going to take in some better energy. And that just brings me to some of the other concepts that I have to share, a little something to think before we get totally going and started here tonight. Is it possible that plants, like people, have personal relationships? All basic things being equal, such as light and temperature, will your plants do better in some quadrants of a yard than others? And oftentimes we don't take into consideration that plants actually have relationships, just like animals and people have relationships. And when you bring another pet, for example, into a home, sometimes they're going to get along with the existing pets, and sometimes they're going to fight with each other. And most people don't think about this with plants. You know, for most people, they think, well, if I just give them the right conditions, right, water, sunlight, whatever they need, they'll either grow or they'll die. Now, Paul Byrol actually specializes in this, and he's an herbalist. He's founder of the Hermit's Grove in Kirkland, Washington. He studied and looked at this very thing. He's found that plants that are placed in the wrong section of a garden or area, next to something that's incompatible for it, one of those plants can actually release toxins through the soil and kill off another plant. So this is something we're going to be discussing with him tonight. And this concept really intrigues me, because it gets me to thinking about how this can happen not only with plants and animals, but also with humans. And oftentimes we don't even see or understand it. So think about it. If you were forced, for example, to sit somewhere or stand somewhere and you didn't like it, say you're in an office and you get put in that really cold part of the office or the really hot part of the office because that's just the wrong positioning for you, and you weren't allowed to move, how would you feel about that? I mean, that would be really uncomfortable. And this aspect brings up a concept of fight or flight. So it's kind of like a survival. And most people, I would say, would take some pretty chaotic measures if it was a me or them scenario. Now, nature's a great teacher for us in regards to this, and it shows us so much about ourselves if we're willing to observe and learn from it. And when we look at this energy dynamic with plants, it seems to be no different than other things that we consume. The energy of food within our bodies, its life, and what has happened to it greatly influences how it's going to do in our bodies and thus affect how we are with others and in other situations. So it's a cascading effect of energy that's going on here. And if we take care to make certain that our plants and our things that we grow and consume are given the right conditions, then they can strengthen us. And if we're willing to do this for ourselves as well, I think that's an important fact. So it's a lot of things that we want to consider. So I'm going to give you a couple of questions here to ponder a little bit before we go into break, and that is, are you allowing yourself to continue to create favorable conditions in your life so that you can be your best? Are you willing to set aside being right or wrong and make adjustments so that both you and others can thrive and flourish? And how much more enjoyable would life be for you and others if you cultivate and support favorable conditions? I'm going to take a short break, and when we return, I'm going to have Reverend Paul Byrol with us sharing his expertise in herbal gardens. And the song that I have for you tonight is called A Walk in Epping Forest. It's by Claire Hedin. She was on at the end of December, and you can always check out more of her work at clairehedin.com. And I've also got the replay of that show on our archive shows, so you can always look at that and check out her work there as well. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Through Epping Forest. So there I go, walking through the forest of my youth. My feet go one, planted in front of the other, walking on the pathway, covered in leaves, different colors, different stages of decay, of brittleness, subtlety, suppleness, fern and bracken, interwoven, different vegetations, talking to each other, nestling amongst each other, intertwining amongst each other. And as I look up to the forest of the trees above, the tall, tall trunks reaching to the sky, to the sun, to the rain, everything has its place. The sunlight is dappled across the leaves, across the ground, across my face, my hair. And as I walk, I feel the forest wrapping itself around me and at the same time opening itself up for me. And we are one. As I walk, it walks with me. As I move, it moves. One expressing the other, connected. And then comes a breeze. The leaves rustle. They bend. Constantly shimmering in the sunlight. Creatures, the little animals, the little insects, everything so populated, So busy, so silent, so loud. Movement, movement, movement. So graceful, this movement is so graceful. This earth is so beautiful. It's so alive. Constantly dying, regenerating, constant motion, cycles of being. And I'm in that. I'm a part of that. Not from it. So beautiful.
Great. We are back, and if you're just joining in with us, this is Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour. My name is Jessie Ann Nichols George. I am your host tonight. And we have guest on tonight, Reverend Paul Birrell. And it's kind of interesting, one of the things that I wasn't able to mention in the show description, Paul is actually one of my mentors. I studied with him many, many years ago for several things, from astrology through dream work, past life regression, herbalism. So a lot of different areas that I worked with him. And when I was talking to him before the show, we were actually discussing, I was mentioning that we had Chris Pensick on recently, and he said, oh, yeah, actually, I know Chris, because when I see Chris's work, I also thought of Paul a lot when we had him on, because I was thinking, wow, his style and his structure is very similar to the way Paul structured his work. And he says, yes, he's got an upcoming event, actually, that he's going to be with Chris Pensick, so that's exciting things. And he's also familiar and acquainted with the Grimassis, which we have coming up as well. But I'm ready to bring Paul on here in just a moment, and he is our guest. It's Reverend Paul Birrell, and again, I apologize to him for misspelling his name in the show description. It is spelled B-E-Y-E-R-L, and he is the founder of the Hermit's Grove, the Rowan Tree Church, the Unicorn Ensemble, the Unicorn Newsletter, the Littlest Unicorn, the Rowan Tree News. He is an author, and by the way, Paul has authored over 30 books. I think it's somewhere around 34, 35, if I counted right from his websites. He's a master astrologer and herbalist. He also is known on aspects of ritual, death and dying, ethics, alchemy, initiation, meditation, and visualization techniques. And Paul also manages a prison outreach program and teaches at two community colleges. We're going to be looking at his expertise tonight in herbal gardens. And Paul has authored, like I said, over 30 books on a variety of subjects from herbs, astrology, the Lothlorien tradition, magic and mysticism, tarot, gem and mineral lore, the Sabbats of the Year, hand fasting, and many more. Reverend Birrell was actually, like I said, one of my mentors along the path, a very favorable influence for me along the way. And you can actually learn more about Paul and the work that he does and what he's offering at two different websites. The one that relates mostly to herbs is thehermitsgrove.org, and that is thehermitsgrove.org. And then also at therowantreechurch.org. So both of those sites are available. I do see that we've got a caller in the queue, and I'm just going to let that caller know that if you do have a question come up along the way while we've got Paul on our show, just go ahead and press 1, and that'll get you into where I know you've actually got a question for us. So here we go. And, Paul, I've got your mic all opened up. I want to thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. It's good to be in contact with you again.
It's absolutely a pleasure. I knew Paul, by the way, from the Los Angeles area, and he was coming in and working with another mentor of mine that I was studying with for a while, and a wonderful little shop called Lady Bountiful was the name of the shop. And then he also did some things out of one of the most amazing bookstores, I think, in L.A., which unfortunately closed about a year ago, which was the Bodhi Tree. And we met there, and then I moved up to the Central Coast, and he moved up to the Kirkland, Washington area with his partner, Jerry, and has this amazing herb farm going on. And then I went to Arizona and then off to Utah, so we've kind of been apart and together and apart together. and it's great to be back together. So,
okay.
What I would like to do is to start off with having you share a little bit about your story, you know, what brought you to doing the work you're doing, or maybe what got you started on your journey and how that's been for you.
I don't, that's almost impossible to answer. It's when I was a child, I didn't have the exact definition, but this is what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a publisher, an author. I wanted to write music. I wanted to teach. I wanted to be a priest. I wanted to live near a wooded area in a small cabin with a same-sex partner. That goes back to when I was about 3 or 4 years old. And today, that's what I have. All of that has manifested in my life.
And that's amazing, and I think it's encouraging that you can know so early on in life these kind of details of what you wanted along the way. So why Kirkland, Washington, or what drew you particularly to that area for opening an herb farm?
Well, my partner Jerry, 35 years ago, he bought this house that I'm in at the moment, and behind that, about 28 years ago, added an additional acre of land. And at that time, his partner was a man named Sheldon, who was a correspondent student of mine. So our connection goes way back. When I was in Los Angeles, I flew up to Seattle to teach workshops for a weekend, and we met for the first time. And I went back and called Jerry, and we spoke for 6.5 hours, and we're now celebrating our 20th anniversary this spring.
Congratulations.
So since he had the land, we stayed here. This was the land. This was where we were meant to be. That sounds so grand, but it's the gardens are really quite spectacular. We get a couple hundred people a year that tour them, and they're a large classroom with markers for all the species, and people can learn a lot from the gardens.
And I think that's exciting, because there's not enough places where people can go, I think, and really see gardens like what you have set up. And on your site, thehermitsgrove.org, you've got a whole map, and then you've got little places you can click, and people can see what those gardens actually look like around your property. And there's just not enough places where normally you can go and see these types of things.
I'd mentioned that I'm working with a man in the Bay Area, and I'm currently putting things together, and we'll have a new website up this spring. I'm not sure when, but the new version of the garden tour with photos is going to be far, far better.
And that's great to know for people. I can thoroughly understand that, because I just had to completely redo my own website as well. So I know how that goes of saying, okay, enough's enough. We got to get this going here. But, yeah, you seem to have a beautiful, beautiful property up there, which is very, very exciting. Now, one of the things that you've specialized in that I've always appreciated is the whole energetic side of herbs. And you did a format that was kind of similar to Cunningham's work in a way. Can you?
Scott, I knew Scott quite well. In fact, I published poetry he wrote long before his first book ever came out. So I can say that I was the person who published him. Well, I didn't publish him first. At that point, he was writing romance novels under the name Kathy Cunningham, and I published his pagan poetry before his first book came out, and our books on herbal work came out the same year, just by coincidence. So that was fun.
That's exciting, absolutely. And I know a lot of people definitely know Cunningham's work. And you've done a couple of different books. You've done the Master Book of Herbalism, and you've done also a Compendium of Herbal Magic, which is absolutely fantastic. So when you're looking at things, and I'm hoping maybe you can provide some insight for us about the properties that you consider with plants and herbs, such as elements, planetary factors, and so on. And how do you arrive at those properties being issued to those plants, or, you know, knowing what plants align with which properties?
There are a lot of answers to that simple question. The aspects of the plant that are important for study range from first understanding the horticultural and botanical aspects of the plant, how it grows, what conditions it wants, what it looks like, what its environment is, what there is about the plant in terms of its own DNA and genetic structure that allows it to extract the very specific spectrum of chemicals and elements from the soil to create the medicines that we want. And so then that takes also the study of organic chemistry. I belong to a number of research organizations, and so I also pay attention to the most current scientific research that's being done in the United States and probably even more so in other countries, to get the way that science is looking at the plants from the aspect of phytochemistry. In addition to that, that in a sense is the whole scientific approach. If I have the opportunity to spend time with the plant in person, which happens with some, but certainly not with all, then there's another aspect to understanding the plant. When I'm working with students here in the gardens, I'm going to end up in a different direction here. When I'm working with students in the garden, I try to get them to understand that if they're going to work with the plant in the most holistic way possible, they need to understand as much as they can about the plant, from science to folklore. And when I say folklore, I'm referring to the body of literature which is available from academic scholars rather than the books on the market that are all about herbal magic and herbal folklore. When I wrote the compendium, it had about 700 footnotes, and my publisher, Doug Brown, insisted that they had to come out, and he had an editor go in and do a really good job of removing them. I'm academic myself, and I prefer having them in. When I wrote that book, I had information on 330 different species, but I now have research in my own files. I've got binders that hold information on about 3,500 different species, I think it is. I've had books published in Africa, not by myself, but I've obtained books published in Africa, a limited edition from the University of Johannesburg, books published in India that I have sent with the internet. I get books that are written in other countries, and I can find them and have them sent. So the more you know about the plant, the more you can understand what the plant is, you know, what it has to be simply in order to be itself.
And this is great, and I love too how you're bringing in the aspects that this is really a science. It's not like somebody just going down going, oh, this is a hot plant, so I'm going to assign it fire or things like that.
It's, right.
There's actually a science in the DNA and genetic structure, as you say, of the plant, and how that's going to physically react with the soil that it goes into. And I really like where you brought up the aspect of folklore from an academic perspective and not just what a lot of people think of folklore as.
Yes. When I first started my studies about 40 years ago, since I am almost 70 now, I thought if it was in print, it must be true. And then I began to realize that there was a lot of information which seemed to have appeared for the first time in maybe 1960, 1970, and the only person who ever put that in print was a particular author, and then somebody else would read that, and they would put it in print. So there's a lot of new folklore that's been written about the field of herbal medicine, or not herbal medicine, herbal folklore, that has no historical basis. It has to be older than World War II, unless it's information which comes out of, there's a field called ethnobotany, and there's a lot of ethnobotanical research that's been done in the southern parts of Africa, in India. There's a magnificent book in the United for the United States by Daniel Moorman, M-O-E-R-M-A-N, called Native American Ethnobotany. And these are researchers who, if it's done in at the best level of work, they spend several years studying the culture and the language and knowing as much as they can about the people. And then they go and they move in and live near them until they're invited to participate, and it can be many years before they have access to the actual oral traditions that are being passed down. And they study how plants are used in terms of medicine and food, religion, ceremony, their magical beliefs, and also whether they're used in dyes for building their homes, just all aspects of how humans interact with the plant world. And it's a very exciting study.
And it is, and I love, too, where you brought up this aspect of how the science is connecting with religion or belief systems. And I think that's so important. People think, oh, well, I'll just plant something here because it looks pretty, and they forget about, you know, there's all this whole huge other pieces of things. And fortunately, we have people like yourself who then write a book and just help the rest of us out to make it much easier on us. Paul, I've got a couple of callers in the queue, so I would like to give them a chance to come in and ask questions, if that's okay with
you. Yes, go ahead. I love questions.
Great. And also, for anybody else that would like to call in and ask Paul questions, you can do that. Our line to call in is 760-542-4345, and you'll just press 1 to get into the caller queue. I've got somebody from 804 area code, and let's get you your mic opened up here. Okay, 804, you're live on the air.
Hi, good evening. My name is Hugh. I'm calling from Virginia. Fascinating information, and I have a partner, and we're both interacting with an indigenous gentleman on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and looking to help him preserve the oral traditions that have been passed down for thousands of years that they're just about losing. And I'm wondering if the Reverend might take an interest in that cause. Also, a lot of times, too, people that have interacted and have learned certain things of the indigenous ways have not followed what their teachings are. They're not supposed to be selling this information. And that's a big, big problem, and there's a lot of corruption in the indigenous cultures in that regard that has to be rooted out and stopped. So again, I just wanted to see if he might take an interest in this particular situation, because they truly know how to heal Mother Earth, and that's what we should be focusing on now, too, as we also tap into our unlimited creativity and find new ways of caring and sharing with one another. I'm working on a huge paradigm of bringing spirituality into global economics and combining it with unconditional love, making everything transparent, ethical, legal, moral, and forcing companies to be more responsible for their employees, their customers, the environment, and the community.
Okay. Paul.
My answer is I would be interested, but my current workload is 80 to 90 hours a week, and I don't have maybe 10 to 20 years left for my work, and it's not possible for me to add any other projects. It's simply just not something that can be done at this stage in my life.
Well, just to pass the word along to somebody else, or just because it's a pretty desperate situation they're in, and I'm looking to get his information flowing and plug it in wherever I can, if I can share a website.
I would recommend tracking down Daniel Moorman, the author I mentioned. I don't have, there's nothing that I'm able to do, but you need
right.
to find someone who works in that specific field, and Moorman teaches at I'm not sure exactly which location, through the University of Michigan, but he's a well-known author, and either he or someone through the American Botanical Council, that would be where you should go.
Okay, I'll try that. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be really good. The American Botanical Council seems like that would be a really good option as well, because they can reach on some wider levels.
Yes, you need someone who has the resources to, and the time and ability to do something other than wish they could do something.
And if people are wondering why Paul's schedule is so full, I mean, not only has he done the huge amount of accomplishments in his life that he does, but maintaining the herb farm certainly takes quite a bit of time. He teaches at two community colleges right now, courses, which anybody who's been a college-level professor, I'm sure, can understand that kind of a course load that goes on related to that. And he also does a prison outreach program, which takes quite a bit of his time as well. So he's heavily involved in projects. So I just wanted to clarify that for those people who are wondering, why doesn't he have any time left? But, yeah, the Botanical Council, I would ride with Paul on that and say that that would be a great option because of how far they could reach that project out for you. And they probably also have access to volunteers and some other people that could be very useful for you.
Thank you very much again.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for calling in. And the next caller I've got on the line here is another one of our host here on Main Street Universe, which is Kevin Baird. He's calling in. Kevin, I've got your mic all opened up.
Hello, and thank you, Mr. Paul, for being a part of the show.
You're welcome.
I want to say thank you for the efforts and the discoveries that you've made to help progress our race forward in the most positive sense possible. But I wanted to ask you a question about, you know, something that Jesse had talked about, where, you know, where herbs can be combative to non-harmonious neighbors that are plants as well, and that sometimes the harmony between, you know, the ebb and flow of like positive garden existence as opposed to negative garden existence. Is there something that we can pair that to that could probably help us solve some of the major illnesses that are plaguing us, like cancer maybe, or like blind or something?
I'm laughing. I hear it's a, there are many beliefs that float around. One of them is that there is an herb that will cure every disease that we have. I try to point out to people that if we really, we have to remember that the human species is just like the plant world. All plants are designed to become compost, and humans are supposed to die. And we have a tendency to want to think that we're exempt from the natural order. And so rather than saying, okay, if in an earlier time and not so long ago, most women would have died by the age of 40 in childbirth. Most children would die and not live to be adults. People we kept our population in check quite nicely. Today, however, we are overrunning the planet worse than some of the most virulent weeds and bacteria. And frankly, bacteria and viruses and diseases like cancer are about the only thing that keep us in check other than how much we run around killing each other, because we've made ourselves exempt from the food chain. We used to be part of it, and so we were food for a lot of other species until we developed guns and other ways to protect ourselves. So I used to think that, but now I think that we have to just come to terms with the fact that it's okay to die. I'm not saying that I was diagnosed with cancer, and I went through surgery and became cancer-free. I'm very happy about that. But at the same token, we're not going to find cures for everything, because it's just not the way that life is designed in the universe.
Well, you know, if we can, like, I know that there are pine trees that are like a zillion years old. Like, someone told me that there's a genus that's like Pinus longinia or something like that, that is over like 2,000 or 3,000 years old, based on its, I guess, fortitude and coping with its environment or whatever. There are some people who live to be 103, 110, and there are some people who can't make it past 20, and really it's the experience they present to the world that impacts the experiences that create sort of like a domino effect with the other people that are in their life, kind of stuff. But my thing is going back to the herbs, like, do you have a Rosicrucian study in your background at all? I wanted to know about that.
No, not directly. I've read some of their material. I've studied a lot of, I read voraciously.
Okay. Now, quick question. There are junior masters that are out there who will be listening to this show and will refer back to your pontifications and your prose and your text, and probably this show, if we're that fortunate. What do you have to say to the junior masters that are out there for the tomorrow and the next years, who are trying to really create a transition or a transformation that will bring us to, like, the new stage? Like, earlier this week, we had somebody on one of our network shows who was bringing in something that was known as the Garden Tower, which was an opportunity for people to produce food-producing plants within their home or on their property that could help them sustain them instead of them having to access an external farmer or something. We're in a new age, and that you are a father of a part of that new age that's beginning. And what advice do you have for those people who are seeking solutions? Like, what sources can they seek out, or what ambitions, or how can they remain inspired to continue what they're doing? What do you have for that?
Well, I think that when I'm working with students, I get them to, I mean, I think that what any serious student of any path must do, and I'm really, abhor saying you must do this, but I'm going to in this case. If a person is very serious about the study of any metaphysical path or philosophical pursuit, you have to study the whole of life. You have to understand humans. You have to understand the history of religion, how religion changes constantly and remains the same, how humans live on this planet for good or for bad, and then look at other species as well, the plant world. One of the values of the plant world is I think that they're better role models than humans are. They are always struggling. They do wish to dominate. Almost every species of plant is no different than a human. They want to spread their genes everywhere and take up more and more space. But they manage to coexist and not pollute. We live a very sustainable life. We harvest water. We save water. We don't flush a toilet. We have all sorts of things set up. And I don't know. It's just we practice that we follow that movement, that the simplicity movement, where we do not. I like shopping and things, but we're very sure. low consumers in that sense. We have one vehicle. We buy a used truck. When we need to replace it, we get another used one. We've had our home paid for 10 years. We could easily have sold this property and done like most humans and trade up and get a great big house with a great big mortgage. And I think it comes down to the bottom line is your value system. You have to follow and live your highest ideals. Because anytime we settle for less than our highest ideals in terms of what we can achieve as a spiritual being, we end up unhappy.
Okay, and then just my last question, and I'll let you go. Mm-hmm. You were talking about how you have a reach-out program, or Jesse was talking about how you have a reach-out program or a helpful program that's related to incarcerated individuals. And I've been thinking about how you were saying about something that's parallel to things that I've read before about how human existences are really parallel and mirror the plant existence as well out there. Like you have the sunflower people, you have the daisy people, you have the rose people, you have the Gerber daisy people, then you have like the Virginia creeper people, or the voracious vegetation that wants to just take over as much space as they can get and to realize as much of the whole of the planet as they can realize. And I was thinking that the people that are incarcerated right now are really just voracious type plants. They might be the Virginia creeper, they might be the Venus flytrap or something, but now they've been arrested into a frame that does not allow them to expand as quickly as they want to expand. And I
need to interrupt because you sure. are making a pretty strong generalization.
Okay.
The fact is that most people living in this country at some point in time are within just a hair's breadth of ending up in prison themselves. The number of people who have driven drunk, the number of people who, I mean, you think of all these things that go on. In this country, the average person believes it's their right to avoid making a complete stop. They get very angry when they have to drive the speed limit. They try to cheat on their taxes. They steal things at work and bring things home. This is a country of lawbreakers. And the person in prison, most prisoners, the vast majority, and I've dealt with many thousands for 35 years, most of them grew up with a value system taught to them by their parents. They watched their mother turning tricks in the next bed. They were beaten by their fathers, all of these things. And so you can't just say that they are a type of person. Most of them, the majority of them discover life differently. Those that I work with all treat being in prison very similar to monastic life and see it as a huge opportunity, and they're very grateful for it. There are certainly other types as well, but they're no different than the corporate greedy people who never get caught.
Okay. Well, you're
so
helping me with
be
that.
Careful of your stereotypes.
Yeah, I did not intend any stereotype. I'm trying to understand it. That's a culture that I have no understanding about.
No, people don't. And really, I think that everyone, given that we live in a country that locks up a higher percentage of its population in prison than any other country in the, on the planet, the average person will, in almost every state, consistently votes to lock up more and more people and give less and less money to pay for those prisons. It's a horrible state of affairs. It's worse than the Soviet Union. It's worse than almost any other country, and we tolerate that in this country. And people on spiritual paths, most of them tend to just ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist. So I appreciate your asking your question.
I aspire to be better at that.
Yeah. I mean, if we look at the prisons, today the prisons, the people going in there to help them tend to be from the very fundamentalist religions, either Christian or Muslim, because it's a right place to make converts. And as long as the rest of us ignore the people in prison, the prisons are going to turn out people that we don't particularly want to be turned out of a prison.
And
that's,
I think you
that's a whole different that's a whole different program.
Whole different realm, and there's certainly I know Paul and 20-50 shows I could easily do with you. And I know that where Kevin was going, and I'm actually finding this very interesting that it took this direction, because I always let my shows kind of go where they go.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we might start one place and finish back at that same place and come that full circle just like life. But you bring up such a good point there that a lot of judgments are made on people, and I'm always telling this people, they say, well, how can you love that person or have compassion for that person that's in prison, for example, for murdering somebody? And I say, because there's so much more to the story than what
actually,
we can see with our eyes and hear with our ears and what the press reports. And
the thing that most, I just want to say, when you mentioned the murder, most prison employees, and I agree with this totally, I am far more comfortable with someone who's committed a murder than I am with the person who steals all the time for drugs. Because the murderer makes one mistake in a fit of rage or passion, and they're unlikely to ever do that again. But the people who are unable to get past their addiction to meth and crack, they, as soon as they're out, they almost always go back to drugs because, well, first of all, we do almost nothing to rehabilitate them. And so they're much more of a risk. And then another aspect, since this whole bucket of worms was opened, I would say that a third, and I deal with prisoners who are looking for spiritual education, so I also get the cream of the crop. But I would say that most of those I've dealt with who've committed murder, once they were in prison, were diagnosed with schizophrenia, with bipolar disorder, but they grew up in families, broken homes, they had no money for good health care, which if you don't have wealthy parents in this country, you don't get health care. And so they didn't know that the voices telling them to do what they were doing, that was a mental disorder. I mean, the incidence of mental illness that puts people in prison is very high.
Mm-hmm.
And if those people had had treatment, they would never have done that. They would not.
And
that's not all of them. And I don't even want people to think I mean all, but there are a lot of them who fit this that I deal with. It's quite amazing, really.
And it is, and this kind of it ties back in, and we can kind of circle back around a little bit here.
That's your job, to get us there.
It's my job to get us there, and I'm pretty good at that. But what you're bringing up comes back to some of the original concepts and questions that I was posing with people, which is the fact of energetics, the energy, the vibration, the feelings, the emotions. And just like we have feelings and emotions, plants have feelings and emotions, it seems to me, at least in my opinion. You know, they feel better in certain environments, like you say, because they have the right physical conditions. And had these prisoners had the right physical conditions and then been fed with the energetics of love and other things, they could have had a completely different outcome in their life.
We would have a lot less people. There is certainly always an element in our species that is, well, I'll say that there is criminal by nature. If we look at some of the oldest religious myths, one brother killed another brother. I mean, so that's, how old is that story? I mean, and they're trying to explain why people can just be crappy. You know what I mean? We're not always a really nice species. And that comes down to what our job is, in the sense of I can't remember the man's name now that who was just speaking. He was asking
Kevin.
what people can do. And you have to discover how to live in harmony with the world around you. And you have to be a role model more than anything. You can run around and try to teach, but then you're just another preacher. But if you live your life differently, then people are inspired when they see how you are. And that's what the religious leaders are in all religions historically. And they all deal with prisoners and people who are disenfranchised.
And that's a great point. And it's just like, if you have a plant that's thriving and it's beautiful and it's gorgeous and it's showing, look at what you can become. And here's this little seed starting to come up out of the ground, and it's looking around saying, and it's going to take that role model on. You know, whatever it sees, it's going to take that role model on. So,
unless you grow it in toxic soil.
Unless you grow it in toxic soil or next to something that's going to suffocate it out, which,
yeah.
You know, definitely is one of those things I want to get to here, because I think this is, you know, sometimes something good, sometimes not so good. You know, as my sister says, a weed is, she's a master gardener, and she says, you know, a weed is anything you don't want in your yard.
And in our garden, there's almost every single species we have is trying to take over the entire garden. I mean, literally. You know, given the chance, if we didn't cut back the lavender before it goes to seed, we have thousands of lavender seedlings. And we have thousands, I mean, every plant, that's the nature of the plant world, really. If you give a plant and you let it have sex freely, because that's really what the plant world is all about, is reproducing, and you give it nothing but open, unplanted, fertile, tillable soil with no other plants growing there, it will reproduce faster than any other weed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, the problem with our human species is we're now reproducing without being held in check because somehow we just don't do it in moderation.
Right, right. And isn't that the key to a lot of things, moderation, right? I mean,
mm-hmm. Yes, I love that word.
Even some of the best things in life can become not such a great thing in excess.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true. Well, it's just we need variety in our diets. We need moderation and a lot of different things. Now, how does somebody know, like, that doesn't have as much of a big giant background as you have to work from, how do they know what to plant or not plant next to each other in their gardens? Here we are, we're coming up on this time, and I think about this because we think of spring being that time that we're going to plant things and we're going to, start our gardens and everything like that, but you almost got to do a little bit of of planting? Like, how do they know whether to put the plant in the south quadrant of the yard or the north quadrant, or what to put next to each other?
But first, I think for me, I just try to give the plant what would be its most natural environment. You know, if it wants partial shade, it should get partial shade. And as far as, and if it's used to growing near coniferous trees, then that's what you where you should plant it. And that's about all I do. There are books on what's called companion planting, where you should plant this species next to that species and things like that. But that's not quite how they grow in the wild. They, given their own, they just sort of happen to be next to whatever else is growing there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tend to just, the more harmonious I am with my life, the more I just sort of know where to put things. And if they don't live, then I'll put it someplace else next year. Or if it isn't happy, I'll pick it up and move it. I let the plants tell me where they want to go.
So that kind of paying attention, just like if you're trying to do something one way in your life, if it's not working, change it.
Yes, I'd rather listen to the plant world than someone's book. Although as an author, I guess I should tell people that you should really buy books.
buy my books, but still listen to the plant.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that is great advice, really looking at what is natural, because I think we've run into so many different things with seeds blowing in, traveling on car tires, things like this that bring things that aren't natural to a region into it.
I have some interesting things about that, too, because many of the plants that we consider indigenous actually aren't indigenous in the first place. They've just been there long enough that we forget that they came over with the first peoples that crossed over out of Asia. When they came over thousands of years ago, they brought plants with them. And today we look at them and think, oh, these plants have been, they were here before the European, I call it the European invasion when our ancestors all came over. They were here before then, and so we think, oh, these are indigenous plants. In addition to that, we want to remember that our planet is composed of what we think now of these continents, but the continents are always moving. And the top scientists that study plate tectonics currently believe that there have been four or five times that all of the continents were pushed up against each other, then they separate and move around again. So there are times when all of the species can easily wander all over the place. So even at that, when you think about that, and then you realize that, I don't know how. So I'm just never completely sure anymore just how indigenous species are, because even with herbal medicine, the oldest global trade that we had was in spices and herbs, and people were always eager to trade those with people who lived someplace else. I don't know that anymore. That just how old, how long it's been. Plants have always moved wherever they want to. They travel with birds. They get eaten by bears, and then the bear goes out and does what it does in the woods. I probably can't use that word. But plants have always been freely moved from one place to another. There are a lot of birds that can fly vast distances across the ocean. There are creatures that will eat will have something that will, well, let's see. So you're in Utah?
Mm-hmm. I'm in southern Utah now. So I'm at
let's
about
that there's,
6,000
there's some
feet of elevation.
There's a bird that lands outside your bedroom window, and it eats something that's got seeds in it, and it can fly all the way to the coast, And when it lands on the coast, it gets eaten by a seal, and those seeds are in the seal, which gets eaten by a larger fish, which now swims to Asia and defecates, and that gets washed up on shore, and things start growing.
Mm.
It happens. Not quite that literally, but seeds can survive amazingly well. And so they float. They get carried by birds. So I used to think, you know, that I used to have a different view of plant species. Now, when I look at it, because I measure time in a far larger scale than a human life, and plants are, they migrate around this planet far easier than humans ever thought of doing, up until we developed the combustion engine and air travel and land travel that way. Now we move around pretty easily, but plants just go wherever they want.
And I think, too, some of the interesting things that we have going on with the shifts of temperatures and climates and everything like that, that's probably also going to change what turns into being indigenous somewhere, because it might be indigenous for so many years under one set of conditions, and then, you know, another set of years down the line, it's going to change because the climate has changed in a given area.
Climate's changing a lot. We're already seeing many species are dying off at lower elevations and now living at higher elevations. We have insect species moving up here that used to be found in California. My sister in Minnesota says that they've got something that is infesting their gardens that they've never seen before because it's now living further north than it used to. We've really tipped things off balance, and I don't know that we're going to be able to get it set right. It's one study that I read said that even if we stop producing all emissions that cause global warming, it would continue to warm. What we have in the air already would continue to, the climate would continue warming for 200 to 300 years before it would stabilize and potentially start to cool down again. That's a long time.
Yeah, it is.
The oceans right now are in very dire trouble.
I think with that concept, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't seek to obtain balance somewhere.
No, it means we should be working harder than ever.
Mm-hmm.
And when our politicians put it off and say that we shouldn't do this because it's bad for business, the voters, I mean, you know, we live in a democracy, and our public is so complacent. They just, as long as they can do what they want with and buy what they want, they just don't give a rip for the next generations. Really, they say they do, but they should have voted half the politicians out of office, but they just let it happen. And
mm-hmm.
Only a few weirdos like us complain loudly.
And thank goodness for the weirdos that voice themselves up a little bit.
Yeah, it's
and
true. Things.
And I've got, Kevin had another question, which he typed in the chat room, and I think that's all. And another one that I'm going to bring up because it was triggered during some of the things you were talking about with the seeds and everything. But he was wondering how you felt about the introduction of the new life forms to the U.S. For now, he says some see it as bad, but is it bad?
The genetic engineering? Is that what he means?
Kevin, do you mean genetic engineering? We'll see what he types in here. Are you talking like GMO stuff, or?
Or is it just talking about like little snails and things like that?
No. Okay. So he's typing here. So other life. So I guess like snails or birds or snails, he says.
Well, it's, the way that we, let's see, if plants and these other species were moving to new locations in more natural ways, it would happen very organically and very gradually. but with human interference, it happens in ways that throw things out of balance. So it is not something I'm happy about. I don't know that we can change it easily, not without a lot of cost. And this is not a country that wants to spend money on things, not when it's taxpayer money. We just don't want to pay for anything.
And I would say an example of that is like down in Florida, where they've had these other species showing up, and they're just consuming and taking over everything.
Oh, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. There are the Great Lakes are having problems, the Mississippi River. I mean, rivers everywhere are finding other species. They have to try to keep people from moving their boats without looking for different types of things that attach to the boats and get carried from one place to another. It's no different than people carrying viruses on airplanes.
Right.
I mean, we cover a lot of distance today, and we carry a lot of baggage with us in the very literal sense. And up until, what, maybe 100 years ago, humans hardly traveled around at all. And so everything could just stay in their own neighborhood. And the movement and the change in temperatures and the change in species traveling around was very gradual and very organic. And if they went someplace and they couldn't fight off the natural predators, then they wouldn't survive there. And if they went someplace, and this is any animal or plant or human, they went someplace and they were able to adapt and fit in, then they would stay there. But today we clear-cut forests, and so all sorts of things happen, and we overfish the oceans, and the negative aspect of the human race has been devastating. The positive aspect is breathtakingly wonderful. It's an interesting quandary.
And I see also, I guess one of the questions I would have on here too is there's a lot of concern, obviously, about GMO, which we won't go there because that's a whole gigantic discussion.
I'll just get really loud.
But I've got some people who deal in some different things of natural remedies, homeopathy, and different aspects like that that are working on preserving seeds from pre-311. And what are your thoughts on that? How important is that? For example, people that are starting gardens and planting things, to be using pre-311 seeds versus after that?
The largest seed bank is the one in one of the Scandinavian countries. I can't remember which one right now, but they have the largest seed bank. They maintain as many different seeds as possible. They're stored at very cool temperatures. And to me, the most important aspect of preserving all of the species and having seed banks, even more than planting heirloom, is to maintain diversity. One of the challenges that humans have is we've gone into monoculture planting when it comes particularly to grains, and also process of growing so much grain to feed livestock, the shift to eating the quantity of meat that we do, which is very inefficient. It takes more energy to produce the hamburger and steaks that people eat than it would. It just doesn't make sense. And so now it's being done by growing primarily one strain of wheat, one strain of corn, all these things, and that's a very unhealthy, it's just very unhealthy for everything. That's another whole topic that people write volumes on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll stop.
So that is one thing, too, is we want to be open, I think, to that, definitely the diversity of grains and seeds and things like that, but also probably giving some heed to what might be considered contaminated from things. So there is some value in paying attention to obtaining seeds from different seed banks or things like that, so we can keep some of this diversity going.
Well, definitely. I think we need to have diversity in all aspects of life, because that also, when we use nature as a role model, that's what we find is just this huge diversity. We've lost a lot of species in the last century, but we find that in an ideal life, we would be living with people who have a diversity of income, a diversity of religious belief, a diversity of political belief, as long as they're tolerant of each other. But we lose diversity when we lose tolerance, and that applies to plants as well. People are intolerant of anything but a nice, perfectly shaped apple. They don't want to buy one that might have a little bruise in that's grown naturally and organically. They want
it's funny,
to
I
look...
have a somebody that I know, and he'll go to the farmer's markets and he says, I want all the bruised tomatoes, like all the ones that don't look pretty, he says, because they're the best ones.
That just reminded me of the, is it the Statue of Liberty, give me your poor, your... That's what this country was founded on, though.
And you know, it is interesting.
Accepting
and
those
I think,
things. That was the original Christianity, was accepting the poor and the criminal. And mm-hmm. somehow we just lose sight of everything.
And it kind of it had a point that I was going back around to. We'll see if it comes back in my head. But it kind of goes back around to paying attention, for example, in your yards and your gardens, what's in harmony? You know, what is there? What is in that harmony? What is in balance? And if it's struggling, move it and shift it.
Oh, yes, yes.
I'm not sure if this is Kevin that's calling back in again or not, but I've got somebody from 618 area code, so it could be him. Let me open up this mic again. He likes
I don't give him a chance to finish his questions.
618, you're on the air. Hello? 618, area code? You are on the air. Uh-oh, you've left him speechless, Paul. I'm going to mute the mic back up here, and if they pop in with a question, we'll come back. And let them jump back in here. So that was kind of interesting. So definitely, I think that's the thing is there's the question button back up again. Is looking at those things and realizing that some of the best things don't always come in the most perfect-looking packages. And I think this is something that we can apply to so many different areas of our life, especially like when we're looking at compassion. And I just finished doing a couple of shows on relationships and sacred sexuality and things like that, and looking beyond that package and finding that connection. And it's so very important, because if we only look at that package, if we only pick what looks like the best things in life, we could really be missing out on some of the best things in life. So let's try 618 area code again here. Your mic is live again, 618.
Hi, this is Kevin. I hadn't pressed one to speak to the host. I was just going to listen to it because I'm out in the garage trying to get some stuff done here also. But I was listening to him, you know, responding to the invasive species that are coming into the country, and that there's no way to you know, redirect or divert that away from us. So we're in a coping kind of space right now. So the things that this invasive species, be it the ball python or some kind of plant kind of life or whatever, or even like the moths that are killing the pine trees in Virginia area, we're now having to have to cope with something that's going to cultivate a negative, but there's a potential positive as well. I'm looking for some kind of inspiration that can help us really cope with adversity and give us some kind of hope. What's your guidance on that?
Well, let's see. Some kind of hope. I think that hope and faith are things that we don't, we're not going to find them if we're looking out in the world. We have to find them within ourselves, and then we take it out into the world. If you have faith and hope with who you are and how you live your life, then that radiates, and that's how you carry hope and faith out into the world. We have to be the ones who provide it, not look for people to provide it for us. And to me, that's a big difference, because if we're going to change the world, it's the same as inspiration. People think that inspiration is something you wait for. Faith is something your religion should provide for you. It's all of those are the other way around. Does that make sense to you?
I think
yes,
that's
helpful. You?
Yeah, it's a great point, and it comes back to that thing. And I talk about this a lot in my work with compassion, is you can't sit there and wait for somebody else to change or wait until they make the shift. You've got to make the shift. And when you make the shift, others will. When you become that living example, they will too. And, Kevin, I'm going to put you back on hold. I've got another caller coming in here. Okay, and we've got somebody calling in from 703 area code. You are live on the air.
Hello, Jesse. This is Dan.
Hi, Daniel.
And nice show, everybody. We are talking about some very interesting things. And mine was just more of a statement than a question, Paul, and that was a while back we had on our show someone who was an expert beekeeper talking about the disappearing honeybee population. And basically everybody thinks it's a mystery that they keep looking for this answer for, and it basically all comes down to just that they're not being raised properly by the commercial or the corporate beekeepers. So I wanted to agree with your point about how if you give somebody a label like, oh, criminal or something like that, and if they're treated poorly and if they're in a bad situation, then, of course, what will come out is someone that may, you know, commit a crime, or in the case of environment, bees with weak immune systems, plants that are not treated or put in a proper place, not yielding or just getting toxic or toxically affecting the ones around it. So I think there's a lot of stress a little too much on pointing out genetics and things like this, when really environment and how things are treated mean so much into how things turn out. So it's something that I like to say a lot of, if we can find a way to inspire ourselves to have a life economy versus a death economy, to where we just work, science can work with nature. And so my statement just is, I'm disagreeing with you in that how things are treated, how things, their environment, it depends on, you know, the potential for how they turn out. And then I'll just let you go from there.
Mm-hmm. Since you brought up bees, as we have a lot of fruit, we can 200 to 300 quarts of homegrown organic juice every year. So we're very dependent on pollination, and we have a lot. We have an abundance of bees. We have honeybees, lots and lots of honeybees every year. They're not ours. Honeybees travel 5-10 miles from a hive every morning. We have literally tens of thousands of minor bees that now live in our gardens. They've taken up residence. They love the stone paths. We have a lot of pollinators all the time, and the bee population, certainly commercial bee raising, where they stick them on trucks and haul them all over the place. It's very stressful. But even apart from that, bees, when you look at a suburban area, which is the way most Americans live, even a farm home, mostly it's all green grass, it's not there's that absence of diversity, and bees thrive on diversity. They need all sorts of flowering things everywhere, not just sterile. A lot of ornamentals that people grow are grown from seed that's not able to reproduce, and so that's not really a good source of food for the bees either. Bees want flowers everywhere, whether it's on weeds or trees or everything, and that's another aspect of the bee, where the bee populations are really struggling, is we've taken away everything and replaced it with chemlons from coast to coast. That's another
and monoculture, you know,
yep.
Which is an even a more extreme version of what you're talking about, just trying to grow one thing in a
right.
vast environment. And there, we view them, you know, as he said in his movie, I guess, a canary in a coal mine. You know, they're little warnings to us as well. Cause, you know,
we have a lot of canaries out there, and they're all doing poorly.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I just wanted
that
to...
That just means that we have to keep ourselves motivated.
Absolutely. And that, there are answers out there. You know, there are people doing really interesting things, and we can't let our fear always make decisions that have us with the old models. Just like with your jail examples, it's a fear model, and people make these assumptions, and they don't realize that things can change and things can be turned around if the party involved, whether it be the bees or the plants or the people, were treated differently in the first place and had
yes.
the diversity of things that they need in the first place. It's not
yes,
perfect.
When we, when we lose diversity, people become very fearful of anything that is not part of their own monoculture.
Yes, I agree. And as protective as that could have been in a tribal model for societies, in a state of civilization and in a world that's ever, you know, smaller, you know, it's time to not take the fear mentality towards things. I don't mean to confuse things too much by throwing the fear word in there, but I think you understand what I mean. You're making that fear safety decision. Oh, take that and, you know, this is what we're used to. This is the decision we're going to make. This is how we're used to feeling that false sense of protection, or that false sense of that we're in charge of things. We can take control of nature. We don't have to be at war with nature all the time. We can work with it. But we're almost still thinking back to when, like you said, we could be eaten. We used to be on the other side of the food chain. Well, we don't have to always still be combating against the forces of nature.
But we also didn't have glasses. You know, when you think about it, if you reach a certain age and today we get bifocals, in the past we would walk off a cliff in the dark. It was very simple. You know?
Yeah.
It was very simple.
There were different ways to get rid of us. And so,
it happened all over the place. I mean, then we reached a point where we could start carrying light around. You know, we could carry flame in the dark. That changed things amazingly, you know, just that very simple thing to be able to carry fire safely in a container that wouldn't go out, you know, once you were a mile from home and then the fire goes out and you can't see, then you're stuck. And you know,
right. What I would like to see eventually in the future, I know I'm being very idealistic here, but I'm not necessarily comfortable with talking about, okay, more of us need to go kind of a thing. There's too many of us pesky human parasites. I like to think of it more of that we can look inside, use our creative minds, go ahead and continue having lots of human babies, but find sustainable ways to be able to reuse the Earth resources better. I know I'm being idealistic here, so hang on. To where I've even heard people say, okay, maybe we can then build a city underwater. You know, Jacques Fresco, I don't know if you're familiar with him, had talked about things like that. We can use our intuition and our creativity to, yes, if we're still breeding a lot and still living long lives as humans, still find ways to have science that works with nature to sustain us as well as nature?
I think it's possible. I'm not sure that we're going to that we're moving in the right directions necessarily quick enough to keep up with our population expansion, because it's very stressful for the planet. I mean, and in that sense, my solution to everything, my ultimate non-political solution, is what I call a well-placed asteroid, because it's it's happened before. You know, it's nice and quick. It's apolitical.
Dinosaurs.
It clears off about half of everything, and science shows that the growing season starts to return to normal in some places within a year, even after like the great one in the Yucatan Peninsula. That's pretty impressive. You know, and in nature, there were always things that gave us a fresh start. That's one of the things that we've done we've gained so much control and stuff, is we've also sort of removed those great cosmic erasers that gave us a fresh start every so often. And I'm not saying we need to have them, but we haven't.
You're saying they're productive.
They were very productive, yeah. You know, they kept things in balance, and that's an aspect that we've lost.
And as we continue,
and
I guess
there's no simple answers to that one. That's why I always go back to the well-placed asteroid.
Yeah, right. There is no simple answer, and I admitted I was being very idealistic there. But that's what I like to feel inside is possible, that we can reach inside and find ways to say,
okay, we get hit by a very large asteroid every, I think they say, 12,000 years. That's pretty frequently.
It is, when you think about it.
Yeah, and so in that sense, that might just be what it takes. I mean, that's a natural thing, you know? I mean, really, if we want to live harmoniously with the universe, well, that's what's happened for a very long time.
What if it hits mostly red states, Ms. Kay?
I don't know. We hold our annual, we have an annual retreat every year, but every third year, we go and spend a week at Yellowstone. And so there's a super volcano. That's another way that it can happen. Every so often when a super volcano goes off, it accomplishes the same thing. So there are many forces way beyond human control that happen so infrequently we forget that they're still going to happen.
Right. And then, of course, there's the other one you mentioned earlier, a little new virus comes out.
That's a real normal thing. But we lose perspective. We measure everything in terms of my lifetime, you know, with a little bit of my ancestors and what I can see into the future, and that's all that matters. And we forget how inconsequential we've been on this planet until the technological revolution and industrial revolution, I should say. That's what really tipped the balance.
And I remember, forgive me, I don't know the exact group, but I remember a Native American saying what they plan for is seven generations.
I can't remember either, but that's...
It's one I've heard repeated a few times, this seven-generation plan, you know.
We forget that we're not gods. It's not our job to be immortal. That's the realm of the gods. And even in mythology, the gods don't last. They're always getting killed and eating each other.
That's true, and getting into all kinds of trouble.
Yeah. And even the universe, you know, we've got black holes. I mean, death is so normal, and we forget that death is just so normal. And I'm not saying we should all go out and die, but accepting it.
I mean, personally, I believe in reincarnation. I know it's subjective to whoever, you know, you're talking to, I guess. But so I see it as part of just accepting, like nature shows you that nothing suffers forever. You have death, and rebirth. That's why I don't believe in hell, because when a predator kills a prey, yes, it might be in pain and it might be in fear and agony and stress for a short time, and then it dies. That's why if nature is to be the example, then there's no eternal suffering place or anything like that. And it's just, you're just part of the cycle, and that's how I view it. But thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and let you guys go.
Great.
Thank you for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Get it. Okay. And so, you know, and all these concepts that we've been talking about, it really kind of comes back to one of your main themes, Paul, which is that moderation. And if we don't moderate ourselves as humans, then something's going to come along to do that for us. If we don't look at creating diversity, whether it's in our yards, within ourselves, things like that, then something's going to shift. We're either going to create extremes that we don't want to be in, or something's going to shift to create diversity, like the spreading of different seeds from different areas. And I think that's such an important thing to look at. And when we look at that expanding out in the bigger picture, as you've talked about throughout the show, having diversity of people around us is going to help us grow and thrive and different things as well. Along the way, we talk about the bee populations needing that diversity. And I think on an emotional and a mental and spiritual level, we need that diversity around us in our yards and our gardens and our surroundings, and that's going to affect us on, I would say, like an emotional level, which then in turn affects the emotions we're putting back out to those plants and other people and things in our life. So it just kind of seems to keep cascading and cascading. And Paul, I want to give you a chance to get in anything as far as websites go, any projects that you're working on, anything that you want to kind of give a little plug on here that you're doing?
We have, we have our basic websites. We have our basic Facebook pages. We're on Meetup. I've got 12 books in print. I've been working on, my current book is on death and dying. I've been working on it for 25 years. I will probably have it done within the next 3 years. I also would say that I now publish my own books, so they never get promoted. They're just they're done for pleasure and for our students, and then they're so they never make a splash. They're just gentle, like a plant, you know.
Definitely a plant.
My projects are primarily that the rowan tree and hermit's grove are able to have a good transition of survival when I run out of time, because I've been telling people lately that I must be like a cat. I've lived with HIV for 25 years. I was diagnosed with cancerous tumors on both kidneys in 2008, and that was successful surgery with no chemo, no radiation. In the process, a blood clot caused my spleen to almost explode inside my abdomen, and then there was another miracle. Then there was the miracle that got me a pacemaker the weekend after I moved more than a ton of rock by hand, literally. And all these things. So I'm just designed to keep working for a while and finish stuff.
You've still got more to share with us.
Yeah, I've got undone things. But I want to get my book on death and dying done before I die, because it would seem really way too ironic to have someone else write about my death when they finish my book for me.
Exactly. I can completely see that. And just to remind people again, the websites for Paul are therowantreechurch.org and thehermitsgrove.org. Paul, again, is based out in Kirkland, Washington. And I believe you're still offering up, am I correct, Paul, where people can buy some of your herbs, like in dried form and things like that?
Yes, we have a mail order business for dried botanicals, and it will be finally within a couple months, people will actually be able to place an order using the website. I just haven't bothered with that previously, because I just would still believe that people would see something and be willing to put a stamp on a piece of paper. But that's where my age shows. I have to tell you really quickly, I honestly thought that at my age I would be able to live without email. It's email. You know, when you think about it, it only took about 2 years for email to go from a curiosity to a necessity in our culture.
It's scary.
it went. Yeah, it was very fast. It was very fast, and I mean, and I love my computers in the plural. We have four of them. I carry my laptop all over the place, but we still don't own a cell phone. So we have limits. We are moderate with our technology devices here.
I'm proud of you for that and keeping that. And
I have to add one quick thing too about cell phones. For me personally, I was working third shift back when answering machines first became available for home use, and I discovered that I no longer ever had to run and answer the phone when it rang. You know, the message would be kept. It would be there when I got around to it, and I'll be damned if I'm going to get a cell phone so that because I can't go without waiting to get the message later.
And we should take that lesson to heed. You know, if we can't wait until, yeah, you know, a couple hours later to get the message, then,
or to,
you know,
talk
we
on this,
take a look at our life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was liberated when they invented the answering machine, and I will hold on to that liberation.
Well, Paul, I really want to thank you here, and I encourage people to go to your website. Be patient while it's getting revised for Paul there.
Well,
he's
the
got
old
some
one's still
things
up.
And,
I mean, so, yeah, it's still there. But
yeah,
if they check in again in a few months, it'll be a new, glorious, upscale version.
Yeah, the basics are there, and I really want to thank you so much for taking your time here to be with us tonight, Paul. It's been a gift and a pleasure, and I'm so happy to be reconnected with you.
Thanks, Jesse. Thanks for letting me ramble all over the place. That's my favorite kind of interview.
We'll come back and let you ramble all over the place some more. I'm sure we can definitely do that.
Oh, good. Thank you.
We like to do that here. Well, I've got a few things I need to get in here before we close out tonight. Next week, I've got Stacy Hall on my show. She's going to be discussing her Chi to Be program, so how to generate that inner Chi with it, and that's going to be the second of our shows here, kind of focusing on feng shui. Also, as a listener, either live or in the archives of Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour, I'm offering 50% off of half-day and full-day coaching and energy alignment sessions through the end of this month. You can send me an email to jesse@jesseandnicholsgeorge1, that's the number 1.com, to get more information on this. And you just need to contact me by the end of the month, February 28th. We can schedule the appointment for later, but you need to contact me by then to take advantage of it. And in addition to that, because I'm really wanting to help people get going with their processes and getting things happening in their life, you can also email me. I'm doing free ebook versions of my books, Activating Compassion and Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour, through the end of this month for you. And also want to remind you again, we have several shows here on Main Street Universe throughout the week. Wednesdays is our flagship show with Daniel and Janice. Monday nights is Kevin Baird with his Horizon Oracle Journeys. We've also got Darren Bouquet on Sunday nights, who's sharing his psychic reading gifts. Tuesday nights, we now have Mary Phelan on, and she's also doing various different things. So, again, check out the Main Street Universe section on my website, jesseandnicholsgeorge1, that's the number 1, at the bottom of the show description there, .com. And it's got all the hosts on there. It's got all of our shows, our times, all the archives are there. So go in and check it out, even little personal pages for all the hosts here. And you kind of get to know what's going on and check out those shows. It's a lot easier finding the shows that you're looking for in there. And I just want to say, this is Jesse Ann Nichols George. Thank you so much for being here tonight. I look forward to seeing you back here next week as we delve more into Activating Compassion. Don't forget that if you've enjoyed my show this evening, you've enjoyed listening to Reverend Paul Byrol tonight, share it with others. It's going to be available in the archives at this same link, or on the website at www.jessieannicholsgeorge1.com. Just go on into my page there, and it'll have the archived show. And I'm going to leave you tonight with the song Yearning For, also known as Over and Over, by Shem Shai. And I hope everybody has a fantastic week. I look forward to seeing you back here again next week, right here on Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour.
And if I could see what makes me blind, I would soar to the edge of my mind. And to touch what seems unreal, just to show you the way that I feel. And we are in time with time, one with season of change and size. And we are in tune with the tune, caught in a balance of sun and moon.
Whispering secrets that you Still burning, the love is still burning deep in your spirit.